Hi, I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we have a very, very special guest, the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, Sharon Kennedy. She's going to be talking about the importance of the Constitution, importance of the rule of law, and the role of the courts in maintaining that rule of law. We thought we'd take a moment to have a conversation with her about her role as Chief Justice in the Ohio Supreme Court and her thoughts on challenges to the judiciary today. Chief Justice Kennedy, thanks for taking the time to be here with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
The Ohio Supreme Court. I think a lot of folks in Ohio and around the country, they know that every state has a Supreme Court or some kind of final court. What's the role of the Ohio Supreme Court?
So you said it best when you said you think that everybody knows that there is a final court, the court of last resort in every step. And it's really amazing when you look at the founding, how protective the states were in ensuring that they maintained their own independence. And in maintaining that independence, they, of course, initiated and started their own court systems. So the Supreme Court of Ohio has taken a rather circuitous route to get to the powers that it has today. So in 1802, it was established, but the powers given to the court then are not the powers that exist today. Every single constitutional convention where a new amendment was adopted was really trying to resolve problems that the court was facing at that time as Ohio grew in population and territory. Today, I look at the Supreme Court of Ohio as being controlled by the powers of the Constitution and those enumerated authorities given to the court. For instance, we are the court of final resort when it comes to a question of constitutional law of the Ohio Constitution. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're the final arbiter of conflicts between our appellate districts. So we'll take in a certified question. We can take in a certified question of federal law. We don't always have to do that. That's discretionary. We have power over the great writs. And in doing that, that under the constitutional provisions and looking at those kinds of cases. In 1994, Ohioans gave the Supreme Court the power to hear death penalty cases right from the trial court because it was taking so long for those courts to get through the intermediate appellate court and then to the Supreme Court before then going into the federal circuits with habeas corpus. So as you look at that, it's power to, number one, decide cases and controversies. But in 1968, with the Modern Courts Amendment, there was a shift in Ohio. We're a non-unified court system. In other words, there's not one central figurehead that tells all the courts how they're going to operate.
Okay.
Every county, judges are elected independently. Independently, they run their courts. Well, one of the things that the Modern Courts Amendment was trying to control was, how do we get the courts more uniform, recognizing we're not a unified court system? One was giving the court the authority to create or enact rules of practice and procedure.
Okay.
But there is a constitutional backstop to that power. Once the court adopts a rule of practice and procedure on January 15th, it must go to the General Assembly. See, the 1968 Modern Courts Amendment gives that rulemaking power the creation of law. That if there is a statute in conflict to that rule of practice and procedure, it sunsets the statute. Therefore, the General Assembly has the right to say no and veto that rule.
Huh.
Once we deliver our rules package, then we have until May 1st to actually make amendments to that. Any amendment goes back to the General Assembly. And then they vote to say whether the rules go forward. When I became chief, I had really seen the power of the rules. We had enacted rules that had sunsetted statutes, but the statutes were still on the books. we had decided cases that declared certain statutes unconstitutional, but the statutes were still on the books. So one of my first measures was to give the General Assembly a huge three-ring binder talking to them about the rulemaking power as it exists today, why they should be really focused on those rules and understanding the implications against statutes, because it's up to them to stop us. The other thing the 1968 Modern Courts Amendment did was to grant the Supreme Court of Ohio the ability to adopt rules of superintendence. Now, those were supposed to be rules that really told lower courts how they will operate.
Okay.
So local courts have a presiding judge of the Court of Common Pleas and an administrative judge. We made administrative judges under the rules of superintendence the authoritarian of the court to ensure that things get done. Someone has to be in charge. So we also established time guidelines. So you have to hear a former trial court judge in the domestic relations world. I had 90 days to bring a dissolution to closure. I had 1 year to complete a divorce with property only and 18 months if that case also involved the custody of children. By establishing those time guidelines, the court has been working on curing the overage dockets that have plagued the state since 1802, when we first created courts. In almost every constitutional amendment, it was always looking at how do we make courts hear cases within a time frame that's rational. So by 1912, when you looked at the constitutional amendments in Ohio, through that constitutional convention, it was taking 2 to 5 years to get a case through the Ohio Supreme Court.
Wow.
From hearing to decision. So the next constitutional convention tried to resolve those issues. So I look at the court having an administrative power, but also that decisional power. I look at the role of chief as having additional jobs. So under the rule of superintendents, under the Constitution, it is the Chief Justice, once the superintendent's rules are adopted by the full court, that goes forth and actually enforces them. It is only the Chief Justice under the Constitution and a statute regarding municipal and county court judges that can assign a judge to sit in a court if for some reason the elected judge cannot hear the case or there's a vacancy. Only the Chief Justice can write decisions on affidavits of disqualification. So you can be a party or a lawyer in a case, and if you believe your judge is biased or prejudiced, has an interest, or is otherwise disqualified from hearing the case, only the chief decides those cases or a designee by the chief. So when I first became chief in 2023, I had an additional, I think it was like 196 cases that came in on the affidavits of disqualification.
Wow.
And there are thousands of requests to assign a judge to courts across Ohio. First ever assignment of judges program, we did an annual report bringing full transparency to this process and the additional dollars that it costs Ohioans when those judges are not hearing those cases, what the categories are, how their county stacks up with other counties. So you can look at counties of similar size and population. And also that dollar figure, I think, was really surprising to people because you're in excess of $5 million over our operating budgets for salaries of judges across the state. We also did, in that assignment of judges program, really show you the amount of time that it takes to get an assignment filled. Taking over as chief, we had assignments that had been pending for 6 months. Recently, the court heard a case where it's alleged that one assignment hadn't been filled for more than a year.
Wow.
So, of course, being transparent and someone who believes that justice delayed is justice denied, we started digging in with that project first. And now Chief Justice Moyer's guidelines for the assignment of judges program and our software system that we call Igor, for the man who created it, they are intuitive. They are there in line. So when a judge an administrative judge opens it and makes a request for the assignment, they have to go through all of the questions and give us full transparency as to why this request is being made. And it gives us the ability to immediately fulfill it.
So that, to me, that's fascinating, because I think a lot of our listeners would not know how many administrative duties that the Ohio Supreme Court, and particularly you as Chief Justice, have. They might just think, well, it's their job to just decide legal cases that get up there. You really have to superintend, as you said, an entire judicial system of a very large state that was, as you said, not a uniform system, in some ways bubbles up from the bottom up, really, in many ways, rather than is dominated from the top down. I'm going to ask you another question, because I was thinking about the job, for example, that the Chief Justice of the United States have compared to the Chief Justice of an Ohio Supreme Court. It's certainly one of the differences between the federal system and our state system in Ohio that even you as Chief Justice are elected. What challenges, particular challenges, does that cause for you as a jurist, if any, that you're an elected judge rather than an appointed judge?
I don't think there's any real controversy of standing for election. In fact, I believe that is the appropriate system. So in 1802, when our first constitution was enacted, ratified, in 1803, it called for the appointment of judges by a joint resolution of the House and Senate. Well, what happened from 1803 to the 1851 Constitutional Convention is that judges fell prey to the politics or the whims of the General Assembly. So you were only being appointed for a very short period of time. As a result of that, when political parties ebbed and flowed with control of the chambers, judges would not continue on their course. So it was 1851 constitutional debate where they actually debated the controversy of electing judges. It was something that was not favored until you really get to that point, and it is a gentleman, the representative, the delegate from Fairfield County that I always quote, who told the delegates, when you have the ability to elect judges, then you are holding them accountable to the people, and they can remain during good standing. But to him, he had seen the folly of those who were not responsible to the people, with no connection to the citizens, who were merely despots and engaging in tyranny. So for him, it became really an important part. There have been two attempts to remove our power to vote for judges, one in the 30s and one in the 80s, almost identically 50 years apart to the day. And what I say to citizens is, you have to be good stewards of your vote. Would you willingly give up the right to vote? I would not. To me, the other system is, do you trust 10 people sitting in a room to decide who's going to be judges at your highest courts? At what point in time does that back room become politicized with only certain people having a voice and making that important selection? I enjoy getting out on the road and talking to Ohioans. It's there where you really hear from them. So one of the things that happened running for chief is I would go to these forums and I would be talking about my judicial philosophy, what my vision is as being chief, the importance of the role of chief. And invariably, I would be stopped by individuals who could not get their case heard. They had been sitting in court for years. Wow. One gentleman had been in a Cleveland court for 5 years with no resolution. One woman had her case tried, and she was still waiting for a decision 2 years later. So that was my promise to Ohioans. I would begin on day one looking at the issue of overage cases. I initiated a three-phase program. We're in our final phase that launches next year. We have made great strides in getting courts to pay attention to the time guidelines. And with those improvements, we've also helped courts with our services from the court. So we have a multitude of different offices that also aid courts. One of the other things that led us to is, you know, parties and lawyers felt trapped that they couldn't go to court and say, what happened to my case? Where does it stand? One of my promises was we would bring to fruition the case inquiry form. So if you go to our webpage, right there's a button. You hit it. You fill out this thing, this form. If you're a party or a lawyer to the case, our staff calls the court, speaks to the administrative director to say, we want to know the status of this case. It's confidential. We call the party back that called us or made the inquiry. And then because the use of that form is deemed irrelevant at that point in time, we get rid of the forms.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
It's clearly part of your judicial philosophy that you have brought to the Ohio Supreme Court, as you said, is justice delayed is justice denied, and the importance of the efficiency and transparency of the courts. That's on the administrative side. What about on the decision-making side? You mentioned your judicial philosophy and that you would talk about it to the voters. For our listeners, how would you characterize your judicial philosophy?
I characterize my judicial philosophy as, if you look at judicial philosophy on that continuum, to the right, where it is the text, and it is the text as understood at the time of which it was written, and that is the only guidepost. It is not how I feel. There are plenty of times I leave court that I am unhappy with the decision, but that's really up to the General Assembly or the people of Ohio to amend their constitution. We're one of the few states that you have a right of referendum to modify your constitution, which is why our constitution has grown and now exceeds 100 pages. But you cannot be an individual that reigns power over the law and to say you're outcome determinative, which we believe, or I believe, really puts the law out of balance and destabilizes the rule of law. But there is a national organization that actually looks at what countries are more likely to thrive. And one of the top three things they look at is, does this country have the rule of law?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If they have the rule of law, is it being applied in a fair and impartial manner? In other words, there's no influence, whether political or legislative, there's no influence by the media. And are they just following the text of the provisions? So we can have lots of debates over what text says, but to me, it's really easy when you read a passage. If you are not the subject of the sentence, that can't be something that gives you enumerated power. In being that textualist originalist, I believe the Constitution gives us enumerated power. Someone said to me once, well, if the Constitution doesn't say you can't do it, then you can. And I strike against that. It is only the powers that we have enshrined in the Constitution that we actually can exercise.
So can I ask you then a little bit more then about your understanding of the relationship between the Ohio Supreme Court and the other branches of government in Ohio, the executive branch and the legislative branch? As you know, years ago, before you were chief, there was controversy between the legislature and the Ohio Supreme Court over things like funding of schools. And there was a number of back and forths on those. What's your understanding now of the relationship between the Ohio Supreme Court and the Ohio legislature?
It's interesting because one of the things that I talk about is this fact. Cleon Susskind wrote a book called The Making of American, the substance of and meaning of the Constitution. And he says that you need to think of the powers of separation vertically and horizontally. Vertically, local, state, and federal. Horizontally, legislative, executive, and judiciary. In this horizontal, it is the court that actually decides whether something is constitutional or not. But it is not the authority of the court to then pick up the pencil and become the General Assembly, the legislature. So in that famous case that you talk about, Durolf, there were four Durolfs. In Durolf 1, the court struck it down, the funding mechanism, saying it was unconstitutional. Goes back to the General Assembly. In Durolf 2, they again, looking at the new funding plan, said it's still unconstitutional. It goes back to the General Assembly. In Durolf 3, it comes back, and the court says it's still unconstitutional, but then the court takes the measure of picking up the pencil and creating the funding formula. It was a matter of days before the motion for reconsideration was filed because the court relied on faulty evidence in creating that school funding formula that far exceeded the possibility of a budget of the state of Ohio. Quickly then, of course, you grant the motion for reconsideration. The parties go to mediation. It fails. And it comes back to the court who grants the motion for reconsideration, vacates their order in Durolf 3, declares the plan unconstitutional, and remands it back to the General Assembly. Being that person of judicial restraint, you would never pick up the pencil and perform the duty of the General Assembly.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter how that's perceived. So the first...
Sure. Though, but that must be frustrating for judges who hear a case over and over again, and they keep sending it back to the legislature saying, will you guys please get this right? And they keep getting something that they think is wrong. How do you avoid the temptation of trying to impose yourself as a legislator?
You have to be firm in your conviction of restraint. You have to be firm in your conviction of the Constitution and serving within that limited role. It is not for us who wear black robes to decide all things. I need people to think in terms of what that looks like, how the General Assembly enacts a provision of law versus how we work. So in the General Assembly, if there is an idea for a law, it goes to a committee. That committee investigates. They hear proponents and opponents. They do public hearings. That is not what we do. We sit in solitude. We read briefs, a cold record. And we are not in a position where we take opponent or proponent testimony, where we ask the people what we think. We do public comments for our rulemaking authority, but not for how we're going to decide a case. It doesn't lend itself to that decisional-making power of being the final arbiter of public policy. And you have to avoid the temptation by being firm in your commitment to that restraint and to honoring your limited role in government to say what the law says, not what the law should be.
On Constitution Day, you've already mentioned it, the importance of the rule of law and the importance of the courts in upholding the rule of law. When you look out on the scene today in Ohio and perhaps across the country, what do you think are some of the greatest challenges today to the rule of law?
I think the greatest challenge to the rule of law is overreach by judges themselves. I think that the misunderstanding of the role of judges. So I recently gave the State of the Judiciary speech, and the focus of my speech was really the preservation of judicial independence. And I really talked about three topics, most of it as it relates to the judiciary itself, but also the civic education piece. I believe that judges should engage in more civic education. You can preserve judicial independence when the public really understands the limitation of your role. When I started running for the court in 2011, I had so many people talk about Durolf and why can't I just hold all the members of the General Assembly, the 99 members of the House and the 33 members of the Senate in contempt, throw them in jail until there's a new school funding bill. And in the moment, you're kind of smiling and kind of chuckling to yourself, but this is a person who earnestly believes that's what we should do. Mm. But under the Constitution, we don't have the power to enforce our own orders. We look to other branches to enforce our orders. Yes, is there a power of contempt? Yes. And when I was a trial court judge, not at the Supreme Court of Ohio, we decide what the law says and then remand it back to the lower courts or remand it back to the body. The first case that I wrote as a majority author, I'll never forget it, was State versus Smith. And the question was whether or not an individual could be charged criminally with violating a civil protection order. But the line in the statute said that in order to charge a respondent with a crime for violating a civil protection order, that the law had to be complied with and all the requirements of 3113.31 must have been complied with. Well, one of those provisions, very succinctly, plain, black and white, is that the respondent must have been served with the order by law enforcement. It was clear in the facts of the case, this respondent had never been served. Well, the petitioner was telling the court, well, I told him about that. That's not what the General Assembly required. So, writing for the majority, showing the text of the statute, it was the first time I also became aware that you're not in Kansas anymore. As a trial court judge, there was very little controversy of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But when you step onto that state stage, it's on the front page above the fold of every newspaper. In the online comments or the published comments of, you know, she must like to see women beaten. She must like X, Y, and Z. And you're scratching your head saying, I'm a former police officer. I was a police officer at the time you couldn't effectuate an arrest unless you actually saw the violence. And then after the burning bed in New York, that changed. Now you can effectuate an arrest if you can discern who the actual aggressor is. But for people to take that kind of a take on it, it's clear they don't understand the role of the judiciary. But the very thing that happened next, and what the dissent said was substantial compliance is enough, that's not in the statute. The General Assembly takes the law back. They erase those words in the statute that caused the majority to decide the case the way they did, and they rewrote the statute. And that's the perfect reflection of our constitutional bodies working. That's the only way this works. If one branch of government is usurping the power of the other, you will no longer have a constitutional republic.
Can I ask you, this is it's remarkable, obviously, from your vantage point as Chief Justice, you've seen the whole Ohio judicial system at work from a unique position. For young people who are out there thinking about becoming a lawyer, perhaps going into the practice of law, in the way that you did, perhaps becoming a judge, and maybe even aspiring to the Ohio Supreme Court someday, what advice would you give to young people? Think now that you looking back a little bit on your career. Of course, there's much left to go, but looking back,
we hope,
of course.
But what advice would you give to young people thinking about a career in the law?
I think the first thing that I would say to young people today is, if you have a yearning to serve, if you have compassion in your heart, if you are empathetic, if you believe that your greater good and your calling is to help people through difficult times, go to law school, become a lawyer. Ohio is suffering from legal deserts just like all the other states. The General Assembly just enacted a bill that if you go to law school and you practice in one of those legal deserts, that you can get reimbursement for your student loans. We are encouraging judges as part of our preservation of judicial independence to go into schools and talk about the good works and deeds that we do. So many young people answer survey questions that what they're really looking for in a career is that thing of giving back, of feeling like you're accomplishing and helping someone. There is no greater gift than to help a family through a legal crisis, or to help a family adopt a child, or to help a family resolve conflict, or to help a business owner enforce a contract so their business can grow and flourish. Sadly, too many people think about lawyers in the negative, and I don't. I think we are a noble, honorable profession, and we need people with a calling heart servant leadership in order to help people struggling. If judicial independence is about fair and impartial hearings, legal deserts really are a threat to that judicial independence because there aren't people there to represent those families through those crises. To me, I look at that to say, give law school a thought. Come to the Supreme Court of Ohio when you're in college. We have externships. We actually give you real things to do so you can work with our judicial attorneys. You can discern for yourself. You can watch oral arguments. Invite me to your high schools. I would love to come in and talk about my passion for the law that had a very long journey through different paths. I never thought I would be the chief of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I thought I'd be the chief of police department. And then all of a sudden, a new pathway opens.
Well, it's been an amazing journey so far. We look forward to seeing what the future holds for Chief Justice Sharon Kennedy. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.